1290.
Good afternoon and welcome to another edition of AHA Presents About Education. I'm Neil Kreisel and I'm your host every week right here on AM 1290, repeated at 10 and on Saturdays at 4. We're brought to you by Montecito Bank and Trust, proudly serving our communities and their financial needs for over 40 years. Pierre LaFon, Wendy Foster, offering fine clothes, good food, and vintage wines. CSU, Channel Islands, no matter which of their academic programs you choose, you will be at the center of your educational experience. And Sansum Clinic, whose multi-specialty team of medical professionals have been providing quality care to you and your family for 98 years. And we're here today with White Buffalo Land Trust, with Steve Finkel, who's the founder and president, and Jesse Smith, director of land stewardship. Thank you for being here, guys.
Thanks so much.
So White Buffalo Land Trust is all about buffaloes, right? This is about having buffaloes live in Santa Barbara.
You weren't joking with the hard questions first.
Right. I did my research, and I'm sure I didn't read anything, but I'm assuming that's what it is, right? White Buffalo Trust has an interesting story that was its beginnings. You want to share it with us, Steve?
Sure. Thanks, Neil. Thanks for having us here today. And I'm going to start off by just making sure everyone knows that I don't have the perfectly trained radio voice like you do. So you sounded so smooth and silky there.
No, but you don't have a New York accent.
I do not.
So people will understand. You have an American accent, so people will actually understand you. We're going to start broadcasting in New York so people can understand me. But go ahead.
Well, again, thanks for having us. So White Buffalo Land Trust does have a fantastic origin story, and it does include a white buffalo. And includes two white buffalo, as a matter of fact. They were sisters. And they came to our family all the way back in 2001. And we were approached, well, it was actually my mother-in-law and my wife at the time, Lindsay McMorrow, my wife, and Bobby McMorrow, my mother-in-law, and some of their friends and relatives from the Lakota tribe from the Dakotas approached them and told them about these sister white buffalo that were born into a herd in Colorado. And they wanted to protect these white buffalo. They were sacred to the tribe, and they wanted to protect them, and asked Bobby and Lindsay if they would care for them and protect them on their land in San Ynez Valley.
And how did they choose them? Why did they have a sense that they would be interested in buffalo?
Well, it wasn't so much they were interested in buffalo. It was that they were interested in the white buffalo and the sacred nature of them and the meaning of the white buffalo to the Lakota Indians and many other tribes.
And what is that sacredness? What is it about the white buffalo?
Well, it's important, I think, to preface that it's not my religion and it's not my story to tell, but I can share how it related to our family. So our understanding and the way it was shared with us is that the white buffalo are a reminder. When they're born, they're a reminder to humans to be in better relationship to the earth and to be in better relationship to all living beings. And the white buffalo will be born at random times. You can't breed them per se. And they would show up. And when they did, it was taken as a sign and an omen to pay more attention to the earth and more attention to how we care for the earth. And so Lindsay and Bobby had spent years in relationship and friendship with these members of the Lakota. And so when they were looking for a place to protect these buffalo, I think Lindsay and Bobby were a natural choice.
And where are the buffaloes now?
Well, they spent the first 15 years or so of their life in a relative seclusion out on a beautiful ranch in the San Ynez Valley where it would be difficult to see them if you were just driving by. And then in 2016, they were moved to Summerland, California, to the location that is now currently the flagship farm of the White Buffalo Land Trust.
You know, besides the long history of the religious history of the white buffalo, the killing of the buffaloes by the quote-unquote Americans in the 1800s and the early 1900s is an example of the lack of consideration for sustainability. I mean, this is a country that had more buffalo than we needed in the world, and now there are probably, I don't know what the numbers are, but this is a case of really not considering the future.
I think that's a great way to think about that. I mean, White Buffalo Land Trust is a foundation for regenerative agriculture. And I think what's important is the link between the symbolism and the significance and the sacred nature of the white buffalo to many indigenous peoples, linking to today, where it's becoming imperative for us to take a much closer look at how we've tended the earth, how we've taken care of our landscapes through industrial and unsustainable agricultural practices. And that has led us to be in the position we are today, where we need to focus on regenerating landscapes and regenerating agriculture.
And Jesse, your title, Director of Land Stewardship, is certainly one that's really descriptive. And is the farm, and we'll talk more about in the detail in a minute, but is the Summerlin Farm a place to grow things, or is it place to experiment with things? Is this a way of creating best practices, or is this actually has as part of its mission to actually grow things?
Well, I think it's both. It's hard to differentiate between the two. I think that what we have as an opportunity at our Summerlin Ranch is to really be an epicenter for learning and exploration and demonstration for our community. But through that, we produce crops. You know, the ranch itself has a history in monocrop avocado production with some citrus integration. It's been there. We call it a legacy avocado orchard because of it being part of the first wave of plantings. And what we're doing is showing what that transition process looks like.
Is the marijuana growing interfering at all with what you're doing? Some farmers have said that the smell and or the chemicals used are not the best thing for sustainable growing.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's something that everyone has their own unique relationship with. You know, if you're going to be living next to a high-intensive grow operation, I'm sure that the smells and the fumes can have a large impact on your daily habits, on how you wake up in the morning and, you know, how your kids are able to walk home from school and not have to be impacted. But for us, it's not something that's readily prevalent in our direct relationship to the land. It's not neighboring us. But I think that there, like any other crop, it's not inherently bad or good. It has its position as a natural homeopathic herb, and it can be grown sustainably. But like many other monocrop, you know, operations, it also can be done in a manner that's destructive.
So Steve fell into this. How did you get involved? Did you go to school for this type of sustainability work, or is this something you just happen to like?
Well, I think that I would actually say that Steve stepped into this many years before I did. His path kind of took him in many different directions, and we've somehow landed in a place where the synchronicity of our life's journeys and evolution linked up at the right time. My background is varied as well, and it has roots in design, mostly in communication and digital design and product design, but quickly shifted when I stepped into my professional career into ecological design. And so background in permaculture and key line design, and now more recently in regenerative agriculture.
And Steve, you also had, besides the family relationship, you also had some exposure to this type of work?
My origin to my introduction to this space, and I think what led me here today, I can remember the day still perfectly. It was 1993, and I found myself on a piece of land in the Costa Rican rainforest that was about 7 miles in either direction from any sort of human civilization. I was at a ranger station, and I was working on a documentary, a wildlife documentary on the national parks of Costa Rica. And I decided to leave the ranger station and walk towards the beach. And I don't know if you've ever had the opportunity to be in a place similar to that, but I'm sure many of the listeners have. You've got a pulsing, thumping rainforest, you know, filled with species of birds and monkeys and various troops flying through the trees. And you've got an understory filled with multiple species from mammals to insects. The life is everywhere and pulsing. And I was walking through this, and the forest leads all the way to the beach. And you come out onto this beautiful sandy beach, and I heard this like loud caw in the air. And I looked up, and there's just two flaming red scarlet macaws flying as a pair along the edge of the forest just over my head. And it was in that moment, it was just one of those inspirational moments of your life that kind of defines you. And since, you know, I was drawn to conservation, which is why I was in Costa Rica. And that moment sort of cemented it for me. And so throughout the course of my life at varying times, I've been deeply involved in conservation programs. And I see regenerative agriculture as the most optimistic, conservation-oriented practice that I think leads to the greatest solutions for the challenges of our time.
Now, we'll talk about regenerative farming in a moment. You're listening to AHA Presents About Education on AM 1290 KZSB, and we'll be right back.
You're invited to dine indoors or on the secluded garden patio, the sunny patio, or the covered creekside patio with fireplace at Pierre Lafon's Montecito Wine Bistro, where you'll enjoy the popular pizzas and many other dishes from the wood-burning oven, daily specials from Chef Victor, and selections from the elevated wine menu featuring Lafon and Santa Barbara Winery wines. Open daily at 11 for lunch, wine, cocktails, dinner, incredible desserts, and a daily happy hour from 3 to 6 with very unique appetizers in the Plaza del Sol, Montecito Village.
Sansom Clinic, we're there at the beginning.
And all the little and big steps along the way.
200 physicians for your every need.
A healthcare system where all profits go back into our community's health.
Your health.
Your doctors.
Your healthcare system. Your health.
Your doctors.
Your healthcare system.
Sansom Clinic. Good for you.
Santa Barbara residents interested in a four-year degree have more than one choice. CSU Channel Islands is a four-year accredited university offering more than 30 academic programs that are interdisciplinary, multicultural, and centered on you, the student. Your professors are accessible mentors who go above and beyond to help you pursue an undergraduate or graduate degree or certificate to advance your career. CSU Channel Islands is affordable and financial aid is available with campuses in Thousand Oaks and Goleta. Call CSU Channel Islands at 805-437-8520 or online at csuci.edu.
What's that?
This? The newest online business banking around.
Can you initiate wires and approve transfers?
Yes.
Pay bills?
Check.
Cash management?
Of course.
All business, all online, all on your phone?
You bet. My computer, too. It's Montecito Bank and Trust's new business online banking. It works as hard as I do.
Huh. Montecito Bank and Trust.
You got it. Montecito Bank and Trust. Behind every great community is a great bank. Montecito.bank. Member FDIC.
Welcome back to AHA Presents About Education. AHA, using innovative social-emotional learning and character building to help teens. I'm Neil Kreisel, and we're here today with the White Buffalo Land Trust, Steve Finkel, founder and president, and Jesse Smith, director of land stewardship. And there's so many things that the White Buffalo Trust does. Let's begin with the farm in Summerland. You know, what happens there? How big is it? What's its history?
Yeah, so the farm is 12 acres. Like I mentioned before, it was a legacy avocado orchard, and we're in the process of demonstrating what the potential is moving forward in this Central California bioregion and some of our hilly, sloped orchard landscapes. So for us, we have a context where, you know, we have uneven rain throughout the year. We have a significant amount that comes in the winter, or for us, you know, here in Southern California, significant. And then during the summer, it gets really dry. So we're trying to demonstrate how, through an irrigated cropping system of avocados, how we can actually produce more diversity and more bounty in that cropping structure. Whereas we also want to show how we can start to transition to a more Mediterranean climate appropriate cropping system. So actually starting to transition away from avocados and focusing more on some of the Mediterranean plants like figs and jujubes and goji berries and pomegranates, while also showing how if there is a significant deficit of water or access to water, we can also support some of our more arid or desert cropping systems. So growing things like agave and Opuntia cactus and aloes and stuff like that.
Does avocado use a lot of water?
Avocado does use a significant amount of water. It comes traditionally from South America and usually is found in kind of deep, mulched forests and rainforests. And so what we do here is we're able to irrigate them to a point where they do have large crops, but it does require a lot of supplemental irrigation and nutrients added to those systems.
What do you do about the yield per dollar per acre, so or per whatever? Marijuana came in because it was equal. Each, you know, tulip was, let's say, a dollar, and, you know, marijuana was $62 yield. And I just made that up, but it's sort of that kind of percentage. And avocado is very expensive, which I would assume means that presumably it has a higher profit margin than a cactus. How do you sort of navigate the issue of dollar yield to the whole issue of sustainability? How do you tell a farmer to stop producing a high profit, if it is a high profit, mm-hmm. and think about the environment, which mm-hmm. may yield a lower dollar?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's a few different pieces there. What's the old adage in business is either you can make a profit or increase your profits by either increasing your price, you know, decreasing your inputs, or increasing your outputs. And so for us, we really want to show how the decrease in inputs can start to generate higher profitability for farmers. And a lot of that comes with nutrient management, and it comes back to the soil. So we talk a lot about soil wealth and soil health. And so caring for our soils is the foundation for how we build long-term ecological, economic, and social wealth for farmer and ranching communities.
So this will be, which sounds great, you're going to be able to go to a farmer in Nebraska and say, you can do the right thing and also make as much, if not more, money. Is that sort of a goal here?
Well, I think that, you know, first and foremost, I wouldn't suppose to go to a farmer in Nebraska and talk to them about their specific context, just because what we're doing here is specifically relevant to this place. And I think that that's something about regenerative agriculture that everyone is understanding, that it is context-specific and it is place-based. So there are organizations in the Midwest and in the South and the Northeast that are all engaging in this work as well. So when you start talking about the chestnut farmers in the Northeast or the no-till cropping systems in the Midwest, you know, those are the people that are really finding that by increasing the diversity in their cropping systems, you know, decreasing the inputs of fuel or of pesticides or of herbicides or of fertilizers, there is a higher profitability for their operations, as well as a decrease in their susceptibility to natural disasters of flooding and hail and stuff like that. But a lot of that is through aggregate production.
And let's talk about definitions. You know, we keep using the word regenerative
agriculture.
Agriculture. What does that mean? What is the definition of that?
So, I mean, the definition of regenerative agriculture is varied, but I think that at its simplest form, it's reconnecting human health to ecosystem health through the production of food. So it's a shift from thinking that that agriculture is inherently degrading in our landscape, and comes back to the fact that we have a human capacity to increase ecological health through the way that we produce our food. The focus is on soil health, water resources, and biodiversity, while always coming back to supporting the farmer and ranching communities. But those are the main pillars that we rely upon when we talk about regenerative agriculture: soil, water, biodiversity, and the producers that are doing it.
Not to be skeptical, but you know, you listen. I guess it's not California, but you listen to a farmer in the Midwest someplace, and you ask him or her why they're still using the chemicals that are in Roundup, mm-hmm. and they say, "Well, because it works." You know, is it possible to break through that whole? I don't have time to worry about all these big words. I'm just trying to put food on the table for my family.
Yeah, most definitely.
I think there's a fallacy in there, Neil, that's important to bring up. The great fallacy is that it works. So, you know, that'll be a judgment that everyone will have to make for themselves. But there's approximately, the estimate is there's about 60 years worth of farmable soil left on this planet. 60 years worth of farmable soil. That's largely due to unsustainable agricultural practices. So not to pick on any one practice, but we are dealing with a loss of soil. And so when people say it works to focus on GMO seed, industrial chemicals, I would argue that it doesn't work. What I would say is that it's created an unhealthy food system. I would say it has created depletion of soil and a required increase year after year after year of fertilizers and pesticides, which reinforce the negative feedback loop of losing more and more soil. So what's clear is that we need to be making investments in the quality of the soil. As you make investments in the quality of your soil, you actually increase the ability of soil to grow nutrient-dense food. So the only way it works is to invest in your soil. We've been, so to speak, drawing on an enormous bank account of healthy soil for the last 100 years. And we've depleted that bank account pretty far. And it's time to start reinvesting in that soil.
For years and years before 2016, whether anyone did anything or not, it was pretty well understood that we had an environmental catastrophe looming, whether it's from global warming, whether it was from running out of soil. And then we had a change in administration. So now you're not only pushing against the reality, we have 60 years left of soil, we have a government that is basically saying, don't worry, it's okay. And we're going to sell a lot of stuff to China. I mean, is it ever get frustrating that the people who are running the show here just don't seem to care?
Well, I think that we kind of had a little bit of, we touched on this in our before we got on the show, is that I don't think that they're actually running it. You know, they're operating a government, but so many of these solutions are found on a regional scale. And I believe that the people that have the capacity to actually turn things around are doing the work right now. They're in the fields. They're seeing the biodiversity loss. They're watching the erosion creep up their watersheds. They're seeing the decreased production numbers. And every year it's becoming harder and harder to make things, quote unquote, work. There's farmers like Gabe Brown that have seen this firsthand. If you ever want to read his book, it's called From Dirt to Soil. But, you know, he was a witness to his crops being lost year after year to hail. And no longer being able to take out loans, no longer being able to, you know, buy the right seed, and taking a pasture walk and noticing the diversity inherent in the native pastures next to his croplands and wondering why they were still producing seed heads and why there was still ground cover and why there was birds and butterflies and bees everywhere. And it got him thinking around how he was actually running his cropping system. And that's what led him to this no-till agriculture with diverse cover cropping and animal integration. So it brings it back to what created the healthy topsoils of the Midwest in the first place was the large grazing herds, the large buffalo herds. You know, and so by mimicking that through the way that we use livestock and adaptive managed grazing, we're able to increase the biological activity, the carbon sequestration, and the actual diversity in our soils and above ground biomass to create healthier profits and less inputs and more resiliency. So
I don't want to, you know, highlight my ignorance, but if this was a TV show, there would be subtitles below you explaining some of the words you use.
That's very, very true. I mean, I realize that a lot of the jargon that I'm putting out there, you know, is not in layman's terms. Yeah. And I think the thing that we need to remember is that the carbon cycle is something that we are all witnessing in real time, and it's out of balance. We have too much carbon in the atmosphere, which is the major contributing force to the rise in climate temperature or global warming. What we're essentially trying to do is draw that carbon out of the atmosphere. And the most scalable technology we have to do that is agriculture, is that we can sequester carbon in our soils and in our above ground biomass, which is plants, living systems, trees, animals. You know, we're all made of carbon. So we can draw that carbon out of the atmosphere and we can sequester it so that we can start to reverse that climate change.
You're listening to AHA Presents About Education on the Santa Barbara News Press radio station. We'll be right back.
In 1962, Pierre Lafond founded the first post-prohibition commercial winery in Santa Barbara County. In 1972, he planted his first vineyard in the San Ynez Valley west of Buellton and later hired legendary winemaker Bruce McGuire to continue to build on the stellar reputation that Santa Barbara Winery has achieved for more than 50 years. Today, you're invited to experience the award-winning wines at Santa Barbara Winery at the corner of Yananali and Anacapa and the LaFond Winery at 6855 Santa Rosa Road in Buellton.
With some health providers, you get the impression that the final goal is profit. But Sansum Clinic is a nonprofit. Their final goal is health.
Sansum Clinic was started by doctors and is still directed by doctors dedicated to offering the very best in healthcare and healing for our patients.
A nonprofit organization where all earnings go back into continually improving healthcare for our community.
Your health.
Your doctors.
Your healthcare system.
Sansum Clinic. Good for you.
Santa Barbara residents interested in a four-year degree have more than one choice. CSU Channel Islands is a four-year accredited university offering more than 30 academic programs that are interdisciplinary, multicultural, and centered on you, the student. Your professors are accessible mentors who go above and beyond to help you pursue an undergraduate or graduate degree or certificate to advance your career. Programs and workshops in classroom, online, with campuses in Thousand Oaks and Goleta. Call CSU Channel Islands at 805-437-8520 or online at csuci.edu.
The Central Coast may seem laid back, but when it's time to work, no one works harder, including the bank that's grown up here. Montecito Bank and Trust offers customized lending and banking for all businesses, big and small. It's harder than offering one-size-fits-all solutions, but it's the right thing to do. And here, getting things right is a way of life. Montecito Bank and Trust. Behind every great community is a great bank. Montecito.bank. Member FDIC.
Welcome back to AHA Presents About Education. AHA, Improving Attitude, Creating Social Harmony, Bridging the Achievement Gap for Teens. I'm Neil Kreisel, and we're here today with the White Buffalo Land Trust, Steve Finkel, founder and president, and Jesse Smith, director of land stewardship. And we were just talking before the break about sequestering carbon. What does that exactly mean, sequestering carbon?
Yeah.
I think the simplest way to think about that is that there is a fixed amount of carbon on the planet, and the carbon can be held in three places. It can be in the soil, where it does the most beneficial work. It can be in the ocean, or it can be in the atmosphere. And
don't forget to talk about the actual reserves, oil reserves.
Well, those are in the soil.
Yeah.
Yeah. So they can be in the ground, they can be in the ocean, or they can be in the atmosphere. And what's happened over the last, say, 50, 100 years is we've moved a lot of that carbon out of the earth and released it into the atmosphere. So we've created an imbalance in the carbon cycle of the planet. So that carbon in the atmosphere has an impact of creating a greenhouse effect,
right,
which has led to warming temperatures. Now, through the power of photosynthesis and through agricultural practices that can be articulated by Jesse or many, many other practitioners, you have the ability to bring that carbon back out of the atmosphere and hold it in biomass and in soil where it does a lot of beneficial work.
How do you do that? I mean, that's news to me.
Well, simply put, you do it by growing things and by creating organic matter in the soil and investing in your soil health. But
okay, that's despite the fact that we're losing the rainforest. I mean, is that enough to make up for the rainforest depletion?
Well, I mean, without starting to, you know, take stabs and guesses at numbers, I think that the, you know, original question was how do you sequester carbon?
Okay.
And I think the rainforests and the jungles and the old growth forests are a perfect example of what we're talking about and why they are the lungs of our planet. You see stuff like the rainforest or the long grass prairies of the Midwest as these highly diverse ecosystems that are made up of carbon. You know, every tree, every plant, every animal is made up of carbon. And so when we think about the principles of regenerative agriculture, lots of them are drawn from those intact living ecosystems. And what that is covering our soil, you know, exposed soil off-gases carbon. And so every time we till it, every time we till soil, we expose the biology, we expose the roots of that soil, and so too does it off-gas the carbon back out into the atmosphere. So that's where there's a big movement right now in the Midwest to no-till agriculture. and that's where they're actually moving to use new equipment to be able to drill their seeds into their cropping system without having to till to prepare the soil. And that is making an amazing amount of difference for how they sequester carbon. And the important thing is sequestering carbon at depth. So if you look at an annual wheat plant, their root system is, you know, only 6-8 inches deep. But if you look at a perennial grass, their roots can reach up to 10, 12, 16 feet deep. And those roots are what are actually sinking the carbon into depth and having the nitrogen fixing, you know, capacity and feeding the microbiology and all that kind of stuff. So, you know, every time we engage in an agricultural act, we want to protect our soils. But we also want to prevent monocrops. You know, monocrops are something that are attacked by nature. That is why we have to use insecticides. That's why we have to use herbicides. Weeds are a response to an unnatural system in nature and in soil. So we call them the hardy pioneers.
So monocrop is where you don't switch crops each season.
Well, even when you rotate crops, we talk about a monocrop in the form of if you were to only have one thing in the field at once. So a lot of people right now are planting cereal grains like a rye or an oat or a barley or a wheat, but they're seeding it with other seeds, which are including legumes and brassicas and other grasses. And you're still able to come through and combine your harvest, but the other plants that are in there have a mutually beneficial relationship with your cash crop, if you will. So they'll add in legumes that actually fix nitrogen into the soil to feed your other crops. You'll add in something like a dandelion or a sunflower that actually brings the pollinators that help as part of your integrated pest management. So the good pollinators will actually prevent the bad pests. So those are the kind of things that people are realizing, that by increasing diversity, you increase the actual capacity of your soil to produce more from it. So
a few minutes ago, you mentioned covering the soil. Do you mean that literally, putting something like a sheet over the soil once it's been planted?
Well, that sheet can be a lot of different things. That sheet can be mulch. So a lot of people in the orchard systems right now who are growing perennial trees are using, whether it's straw or wood chips or holes from agricultural, like the walnut holes. So there can actually be a material that you put down. Obviously, the better materials are ones that are actually food for soil biology. So once again, things that are made of carbon. But it also can be living cover. So actually keeping perennial ground covers on our soil. So right now, the Central Valley, produces 80% of our almonds in the world. Comparably, the U.S., produces 86% of the almonds in the world, with about 35% of the land mass in almond production in this country. Majority of that is in the Central Valley, but most of those almond orchards have bare ground on them. Hard press, it's almost like concrete. And that's a difficult thing to build biology into and sequester carbon.
And they use all the water of California.
Well, that's a whole other story about their water use. But yes, I mean, but then if you think about the concrete floors, a hard packed, dirt floor, the water that does land there doesn't infiltrate. You know, it's not actually able to infiltrate back into the soil to rebuild our aquifers. It runs off majority of the time. So these are the reason why we keep living roots in the ground. Is one, to actually create the carbon sequestration, but two, every time that water hits plants, it then is able to infiltrate deeper into the soil.
Do you invite farmers to your farm, to your ranch?
Yes. So,
and do you have a large group that are really interested? I mean, imagine you could talk all day long to people who farm in the area and try to help them. Is that part of your mission?
Well, one of the great things that we've been able to accomplish in this last year and a half at White Buffalo Land Trust is we've been able to start to connect with and build relationships with what I like to call a series or nodes of regenerative agriculture around the country. So whether it's in the Hudson Valley in upstate New York, or whether it's in Northern California, or whether it's in the Midwest, or whether it's in Australia, there are communities of practitioners who are leading on regenerative agriculture transition in their communities. And we all stay in touch with each other, which is wonderful. So, you know, White Buffalo Land Trust is really fortunate to be a leader in regenerative agriculture in this region, here in Central California, here in Southern California. And we spend a lot of time connecting with the other nodes, if you will.
Okay, but what about the farmers themselves?
Well, this is where I'm going.
Okay.
So one of the great objectives of our organization and the others is to train future, current and future land stewards to be able to help them transition their land stewardship practices. And so through Jesse and through a network of other accredited professionals, we host trainings. We have one coming up in December. Jesse, you can share the dates on that.
Yeah, so I guess to extrapolate, one of the fields of focus at White Buffalo Land Trust is education and training. And like Steve mentioned, the training part is around future and current land stewards. And so we've hosted trainings through Soil Health Academy that really focuses on building soil wealth through the Regrarians platform, which really focuses on land planning and farm planning, and as well as the Savory Institute, which is focused on regenerating the world's grasslands through adaptive grazing, so the introduction or the reintroduction of livestock in an appropriate manner. And so through our trainings, we have invited in dozens and dozens of farmers over the last year to be able to spend time with us on our land, to be able to do pasture walks in order to share firsthand accounts of the kind of the hurdles and the opportunities on their land and within the region.
So this is because I'm old and I used to watch Gunsmoke, but I remember the fights between the farmers and the ranchers were that the animals grazed the land and the farmers didn't like the grazing because it was bad for the land. And you're saying grazing is good.
Well, once again, it's is it a hammer is the tool that can be either used to help or hurt. So too are animals. It's the appropriate use of them in the landscape that is good.
Well, Neil, it brings us back to where you started us off with the buffaloes of the Great Plains. So it's no surprise that if you've ever seen the pictures of the incredibly rich topsoil that once graced the plains, you have to ask yourself, well, how did that soil get there?
Yeah.
And it was the interplay between the annual the perennial grasses and the roaming herds of herbivores. And that symbiotic positive relationship is what created that topsoil.
So just like the wars we've had in the last 50 years, the farmers versus the ranchers was ill-conceived. You're listening to AHA Present About Education on AM 1290 KZSB, and we'll be right back.
Celebrating 50 years of serving loyal regular guests and first-time visitors, the Pierre Lafond Market and Deli invites you to enjoy their huge selection of fresh-baked sweets, cookies, carrot cake, muffins, and the famous farm cake, granola, Oreo popcorn, wine cake, homemade soups, and the popular fresh juice bar. Or get a coffee drink or fresh-squeezed juice and peruse the famous wall of greeting cards at the Pierre Lafond Market and Deli. Open 6 a.m. to 8 p.m. daily in the Plaza del Sol, Montecito Village.
Sansom Clinic. We're there at the beginning.
And all the little and big steps along the way.
200 physicians for your every need.
A healthcare system where all profits go back into our community's health.
Your health.
Your doctors.
Your healthcare system. Your health.
Your doctors.
Your healthcare system.
Sansom Clinic. Good for you.
Santa Barbara residents interested in a four-year degree have more than one choice. CSU Channel Islands is a four-year accredited university offering more than 30 academic programs that are interdisciplinary, multicultural, and centered on you, the student. Your professors are accessible mentors who go above and beyond to help you pursue an undergraduate or graduate degree or certificate to advance your career. CSU Channel Islands is affordable and financial aid is available with campuses in Thousand Oaks and Goleta. Call CSU Channel Islands at 805-437-8520 or online at csuci.edu.
What's that?
This? The newest online business banking around.
Can you initiate wires and approve transfers?
Yes.
Pay bills?
Check.
Cash management?
Of course.
All business, all online, all on your phone.
You bet. My computer, too. It's Montecito Bank and Trust's new business online banking. It works as hard as I do.
Huh. Montecito Bank and Trust.
You got it. Montecito Bank and Trust. Behind every great community is a great bank. Montecito.bank. Member FDIC.
Well,
Welcome back to AHA Presents About Education, helping teens achieve goals, surmount challenges, stop bullying, and communicate and listen effectively. I'm Neil Kreisel, and we're here today with the White Buffalo Land Trust, Steve Finkel, founder and president, and Jesse Smith, director of land stewardship. And since this show is called About Education, let's talk about the education initiatives that the White Buffalo Land Trust is involved in. You're involved with food service professionals, healthcare providers, public policymakers. What about kids? Everything about the world is going to be dealt with by younger people. By the way, my two guests are whispering to each other. No one listens to me.
I was going to say, you know, this is the perfect time to talk about how we met, and it was actually through education.
Okay, so yeah. So tell us.
Sure. Well, one of the most satisfying parts of the work we get to do at White Buffalo is when you engage with children. I was recently shared a quote with me that I think is apropos here. It said, if you have a plan for 1 year, plant rice. If you have a plan for 10 years, plant a tree. If you have a plan for 100 years, educate children. And that was Confucius who said that, I think.
Recently, did he say it? Or
he still come up with new material every day. Yeah.
You guys didn't tell me this was a comedy show. getting to work with children is pretty satisfying for us. What Jesse referenced is the person that actually introduced the two of us is the headmaster at Santa Barbara Middle School, Brian McWilliams. And Brian knew my late wife, Lindsay, and he knew me, and he knew my vision to create a foundation for regenerative agriculture. He also knew Jesse and Jesse's wife, Anna, and of their expertise and skill and passion for regenerative farming. And he linked the two of us together, and it was a match made in heaven, so to speak. So that's actually how we met. And when we started to pilot our first education programs, Santa Barbara Middle School was very eager to – they approached us and asked us if we would be willing to pilot with them. And so in our first year, we came up with two really creative programs to pilot there. One was an on-campus – gardening class, elective course for students at school, and it sort of integrated regenerative concepts into their already existing fantastic and bountiful school garden. The second program we came up with was a Friday-only elective that was for multiple hours, and it was a series of field trips off campus that exposed the students to what we called the ecological hotspots of Santa Barbara and introducing them to the interplay between the ecosystems and commerce and community at various parts around the county, which was really well received by the students.
Do you have internships for young people?
Yeah, we actually we just started one of our first interns a couple weeks ago. We are a young company or young organization by a year and a half now, and so it's usually coming through direct relationships, people who reach out and have a deep interest in the work that we're doing and wanting to come and support. We also are hosting this November back through Santa Barbara Middle School. They have a week-long internship program, and so they'll come out and they'll spend a day out in the farm with us. One of the other ways that we are really excited to be able to engage with our community is through our speaker series, and that's really where we're engaging with a broader audience to raise the ecological literacy of our community through different thematic presentations. So last year we had the farm director from Stone Barns out in New York come and speak about the reciprocity between agroecology and cuisine. How does farming influence food and food preparation, and how does food service and food preparation influence farming? We also had a wonderful presentation on kind of ecological restoration at a watershed scale. So how do we map different ecoregions to understand where regenerative agriculture and what practices from regenerative agriculture are appropriate? And then our third one was, what was the title of that one?
The third one was great. That was Brittany Cole Bush. Yeah. And Brittany is really innovative. She has a program called
Grazing School of the West.
Grazing School of the West, and she uses a mixed group, a herd of sheep and goats, and she'll come into a landscape and tend that with precision and strategy to both help the soil health, but also for fire prevention.
And policymakers, are they part of your target audience to actually get somebody to do something from the government level?
Well, that's a perfect actually segue from that talk with Brittany Cole Bush, because part of the impetus to bring her in was in talking about fire prevention and mitigation. And so truly trying to understand what the policies are that are needing to change in order to incentivize either private or public lands to be available for this kind of strategy. And so right here in Santa Barbara County around the same time, we had a fantastic organization start up called Cuyama Lamb that is providing that exact service for private ranching operations. They're working on conservation land as well as working with the fire department here in Santa Barbara in order to be able to clear fire breaks and create defensible space within our wildland communities.
There's a company that rents out goats, and they're all over Santa Barbara Hills.
Yes.
And it works.
It does.
And there's no gasoline involved.
No, and the byproduct of running goats and sheep is also wool and meat. So, you know, we can clothe ourselves and feed ourselves, which is an amazing byproduct of doing a job.
So the fire danger issue should probably wake, just that alone could wake people up, because we're in a community that has suffered from all types of catastrophes, from not only the fires, but the debris flows, which was also part of, could have been caused by a management issue. I guess this is something that's really relevant today, particularly for this community.
Well, yeah, that hits pretty strong and is relevant for me as well. I mean, that's one of the reasons why Steve and I were introduced to each other was, you know, I was born and raised here in Santa Barbara. In the last 10 years, I've been evacuated 5 different times. My home burned to the ground that I grew up in the Hessisita fire years ago, and we were displaced our entire farm prior to myself meeting Steve from the Thomas fire and the debris flows, and it's been an unbelievable impact on our community, and we all are realizing that in the face of these kind of disasters, we need to have more resilient systems in place, both on a community level as well as within our food system.
You're listening to AHA Presents About Education on AM 1290 KZSB, and we'll be right back with our final segment.
You're invited to dine indoors or on the secluded garden patio, the sunny patio, or the covered creekside patio with fireplace at Pierre Lafond's Montecito Wine Bistro, where you'll enjoy the popular pizzas and many other dishes from the wood-burning oven, daily specials from Chef Victor, and selections from the elevated wine menu featuring Lafond and Santa Barbara Winery wines. Open daily at 11 for lunch, wine, cocktails, dinner, incredible desserts, and a daily happy hour from 3 to 6 with very unique appetizers in the Plaza del Sol, Montecito Village.
With some health providers, you get the impression that the final goal is profit. But Sansum Clinic is a nonprofit. Their final goal is health.
Sansum Clinic was started by doctors and is still directed by doctors dedicated to offering the very best in healthcare and healing for our patients.
A nonprofit organization where all earnings go back into continually improving healthcare for our community.
Your health.
Your doctors.
Your healthcare system.
Sansum Clinic. Good for you.
Santa Barbara residents interested in a 4-year degree have more than one choice. CSU Channel Islands is a 4-year accredited university offering more than 30 academic programs that are interdisciplinary, multicultural, and centered on you, the student. Your professors are accessible mentors who go above and beyond to help you pursue an undergraduate or graduate degree or certificate to advance your career. Programs and workshops in classroom, online, with campuses in Thousand Oaks and Goleta. Call CSU Channel Islands at 805-437-8520 or online at csuci.edu.
The Central Coast may seem laid back, but when it's time to work, no one works harder, including the bank that's grown up here. Montecito Bank and Trust offers customized lending and banking for all businesses, big and small. It's harder than offering one-size-fits-all solutions, but it's the right thing to do. And here, getting things right is a way of life. Montecito Bank and Trust. Behind every great community is a great bank. Montecito.bank. Member FDIC.
Welcome back to AHA Presents About Education. AHA helps teens manage their emotions, support their peers, and serve their community. I'm Neil Kreisel, and we've been here today with White Buffalo Land Trust, Steve Finkel, founder and president, and Jesse Smith, director of land stewardship. And we are lucky to have this group in our community. And what's really great, they don't need money. No, I'm joking. You're having a fundraiser this week.
Thank you, Neil. And your donation was very well received.
Thank you.
I get it on the way out. Is that what you said?
Right, exactly. The check's in the mail. Yeah. I gave it the office. Remember that one from?
But White Buffalo Land Trust is a 501c3 private operating foundation. And we have been blessed to have some very generous founding donors who saw the need and the passion and the desire to see this work take foot in Santa Barbara County. Over the last year and a half, we've been able to reach out to a wider audience. So the list of donors and contributors to our work has grown. And the event you're referring to is our first ever White Buffalo Land Trust benefit called Roots of the Future. And we're going to be hosting 250 people on Saturday night. I'm sorry to all the listeners, the event is already sold out, but it's going to be a fantastic night, highlighting collaboration between chefs and food purveyors from as far away as New York City, including Los Angeles, and somewhere around 25, 30 different chefs and providers collaborating to tell the story and present the potential and power of regenerative agriculture through food.
So are the people who are donors, are they really interested in saving the planet? I mean, is this something like a mission? This is not just another charity, then. This is something that they truly believe in?
Oh, I think that is. There's a lot of different reasons why people show up to connect with White Buffalo Land Trust, but I think what unifies all of us is, first, a love of this place and this region. Second is a desire to provide a legacy of abundance to all of our future generations, for as many as we can think of, and the responsibility of how deeply holding the responsibility is. The same way we care for our children, we need to care for our grandchildren, our great-grandchildren, and to the exponential level of how many generations of offspring will come from us.
So what's your vision for 10 years from now? Where is a White Buffalo Land Trust going to be 10 years from now?
Well, I think what really unifies all of us here is things I mentioned, but also the desire to be on the right side of the history of the greatest challenges of our time. And so, you know, we talked about the lack of soil, 60 years remaining of soil. We talked about fires and floods, and there's enough wake-up calls there to remind everybody of the situation we're in and the power and potential of regenerative agriculture to face those challenges and to be able to be a positive solution.
And I take it you couldn't do this if you weren't optimistic.
Well, I think people have grown tired of the fear and the despair. We all know there's a carbon imbalance. We've all seen the melting ice. And what is so beautiful about regenerative agriculture is that it's just putting one foot in front of the other each day to actually create solutions. And it connects people, it improves the quality of our life, and also solves these problems at the same time. So it's a very positive and very optimistic endeavor.
Yeah. Steve Finkel and Jesse Smith, thank you so much for all you do. Thank you for saving the world. My grandchildren are very grateful. Thank you all for listening to AHA Presents About Education, and we'll see you next week.
It's